Romans chapter 15 and verse 4. Who wants to tell the class what that verse says without reading it? Whatsoever things were written before time were written for what reason? Through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, we might have hope. So certainly, the New Testament writers, via the Holy Spirit, tell us there's value in studying the Old Testament because it can have an effect upon our hope. And I'm sure when the elders set this study up, that was in their mind. And in our study, that's what I want us to concentrate on. Those lessons that we can learn that will affect our hope. So, when you read, and I hope that you do read, because that's the single best thing that you can do, is read to learn the lessons that are there that can affect and help you in your relationship with God. Obviously, in that reading, you're going to pick up some detail. And obviously, in our discussions, there's going to be some detail that we discuss. But the detail itself is not the focus of this class. It's rather the lessons that we can learn to help us in our quest for a home with God. Last week, we began talking about Asa, and we saw the faithfulness of this king of Israel. He comes behind Rehoboam and Abijam, who had been both unfaithful. So we see his faithfulness stand out in comparison of those whom he had followed. But in studying Asa, we're really going to study two kings, both named Asa. Asa 1 and Asa 2, if you want to refer to them that way. And we're going to start with Asa 1. Asa 1 was king for about 35 to 36 years. Asa 2 finished the reign through 41 years total. Two totally different people. The sad thing is, that happens to people. We ourselves can be two totally different people in our service to God. We can live a majority of our life faithful to Him. But then at the end, something happens to us. And we lose our faithfulness and lose it in a big way. And thus, we ourselves can become two different people. This is one of the big lessons I think we can learn from Asa. He's not the only one we can learn this from, sadly enough. There's others. And certainly, the plight of these men who fall into this category, maybe perhaps to different degrees, is a lesson for us. We talked last week about Asa 1. We talked about his zeal in removing the false worship that was in Israel. We talked about how even he had removed his mother from her position as referred to queen mother, and broke down the worship, the idols that she had made, and destroyed those. And how, as Jesus tells us in the New Testament, we're to love father and mother more than him. He certainly showed his love for God to be greater than his love for his mother. Certainly, you know, lessons that we can learn, you know, from how he conducted himself in purging Israel of this false system of worship. We're going to be spending our time today in the Second Chronicles account. And then I want to bring out a couple of things in verse 14 before we move over, I mean chapter 14, 2 Chronicles 14, before we move over into chapter 15. Notice in verse 4, he commanded Judah to seek the Lord and to keep the law and the commandment. You'll find among the righteous kings of Judah, this appears to be a pretty much a trait, that they were cognizant of the law of God. They wanted to know the law of God, and they wanted the people to know the law of God. And then you'll find other kings that wanted nothing to do with the law of God. Remember what happened in the days of Jeremiah when the scroll was found and it was burned? You find kings that wanted nothing to do with it. But you find in these righteous kings, it seems to be explicitly stated in the case of many of them, they wanted the law of God to be known and obeyed to the people. And certainly Asa was doing that himself. And what does it tell us? What does the New Testament tell us about how to build our faith? Is it not through study and knowledge of God's Word? So, as you look on down in verse 11 of this same chapter, and we talked about this to some degree last week, you see this faith being carried out, as he says, when he's faced with this large army that's come up from the south out of what we call Africa. And this army is tremendous in size. He cries out to help for God. There's none like you to help between the mighty and the weak. Help us, O Lord, our God. He recognizes and pays homage to the God of heaven, because of God's greatness, recognizing man, his own inferior nature before God. So he has this attitude of humility, which God requires of us. Matthew 5 and 3, blessed are the poor in spirit, those who come to him with a humble attitude. Isaiah, the humble and contrite heart. He appears to have this attitude as he comes before God. And God rewards him with a victory. And so they had peace in the land because they sought the Lord in verse 7. And he recognized this peace. The Lord is still ours because we have sought the Lord our God. We have sought him. And he has given us peace on every side. So they built and prospered. Moving over into the 15th chapter, God sent a man named Azariah to him. And Azariah came to Asa and said, "Hear me, Asa, and all of Judah and Benjamin," in verse 2 of chapter 15. "The Lord is with you when?" When you're with him. But if you forsake him, then what will happen? And is that not the same thing that he said to David and to Solomon and to Rehoboam and Jeroboam, all these other kings? It's not the same thing. He says, as long as you seek after me and do what I say, then I'll be with you. And then he goes into a brief discussion of the time during what I believe was time during the judges. A long time Israel was out the true God and without a teaching priest and without law. And it says, you know, nation was crushed by nation, and there was just fighting going in and out among the nations. And God troubled them with every sort of distress. But in verse 7 he says, "But you Asa, take courage. Do not let your hands be weak, for your work shall be rewarded." I want you to look at this conversation that man had, Azariah, with Asa from the standpoint of encouragement. Because we see what happens in verse 8. As soon as Asa heard these words, the prophet of Azariah, the son of Obed, he took courage. And what did this courage lead him to do? He put away the detestable idols from all the land of Judah and Benjamin, from the cities he had taken to the hill country of Ephraim. He repaired the altar of the Lord that was in front of the vestibule of the house of the Lord. So you see the great reform that this that he was encouraged to undertake because of the visit of this man and the words that he had to say. And you can go on down and see what happened out of this. Look in verse 9. And he gathered all Judah and Benjamin, and then those from Ephraim, Manasseh, and Simeon. Remember, these are three tribes now that are not under his reign, who were residing with them. And why were they residing? For great numbers had deserted to him from Israel when they saw the Lord his God was with him. In other words, they saw that Judah was being blessed by God. Judah was prosperous. Judah was having peace. And they saw the difference in that and what had been brought about, begun under Jeroboam and continued under his son and the other king that came up after him. They saw the difference between the two. And they chose to leave and go to Benjamin and Judah to be a part of the kingdom that was trying to follow God. So he brought all these together, and then they offered a sacrifice, as it talks about in verse 10 in the next couple of verses. Then it goes on to talk about a covenant that they made, that they were going to serve God. And they even went so far as to say that whosoever would not seek the Lord should be put to death, no matter who that person was. And you can believe that Asa believed that because he removed his own mother from her position that it talks about, again, even further down. So, words of encouragement. Sometimes we don't give enough credit to encouraging words. We're all familiar with Hebrews chapter 10. And where it talks about us, you know, coming together and the idea of to encourage one another as we assemble together. And we need to give thought as that portion of why we come together. Sure, we come together to sing and to pray and to study. And in these avenues, encouragement is offered. Songs of encouragement, words of encouragement that the preacher may give. But sometimes in our conversations with one another that we have, there needs to be words of encouragement. It's fine to talk about a football game or hunting and fishing and, you know, some get-together, you know, that somebody had. Those things have their place. But we need to give careful consideration when we come together to encourage one another in doing what's right, in following the Word of God, in pursuing His service. Let me give you an example. And I don't know the avenue this happened in. I'm not saying this happened, you know, in the building where we worship. But I remember a friend of ours, Harold Trimble, several years ago. He's dead now. He was preaching in an elder up in the city of Bremerton, Washington. But he told me about Bill Cavender, which I think most people here know. And Bill was studying to be a medical doctor. And Harold, Brother Trimble, told me, he said, I talked to Bill that there was a greater need, and that is the sickness of the soul versus the sickness of the spirit. And through conversations, and Brother Trimble was not suggesting to me that he was the only one that may have had conversations with him on this subject, but through discussions like that, Brother Cavender chose to not enter into the medical profession, but to become a preacher of the gospel. That happens through encouragement. You see somebody with the ability to do something, you encourage them to use that ability. You encourage people to do what's right, to refrain from evil, to use the talents that we could go into Matthew 25 in the parable there and talk about. But use those things that God has blessed them with in the service of God. I know people that, I say I know them, I don't know them personally. I've been in conventions where they were speaking. who were men with a great ability to speak before an audience, great ability to hold your attention and captivate you. And, of course, a lot of this was oratory skill, which has nothing to do with the truth. And I know in the case of one man, he had been the best described as a Pentecostal preacher in the past and had these great speaking skills. Well, he left that in order to become a consultant and speak to large audiences of thousands of people and receive tremendous salaries, like $25,000 for a two-hour speech. And he was good. He was captivating. And understanding that he came out of a false system of worship, I understand that. But it always struck me, why would a man leave preaching the Word of God in order to go do something else using the same skills that he'd used as preaching just for money? But he did, you see. So we need to encourage people to use their skills in the service of God. So I encourage you as we're here today and other times during the week that we take the time to speak to people in a serious way, to encourage people to do what's right, to use their talents to serve God, to visit, to help, and to work together in serving God. Any comment or question on this? And I'll say again that this is one of the important lessons from studying Asa. And we'll be able to see this, you know, even with some other kings, you know, ideas of encouragement. Okay. Let's continue on then. And let's talk about Asa 2. Looking still in the 15th chapter in verse 10, it says, they were gathered at Jerusalem in the third month of the 15th year of the reign of Asa. So this is when this event occurred and they had this sacrifice. And then it goes on down and it says in the 19th verse, there was no more war until the 35th year of the reign of Asa. So there was quite a number of years in Asa's life where God gave him peace. But now notice in chapter 16 and verse 1, notice what happens in the 36th year. Here was Baasha, who was king of Israel. And he's built up in the city of Ramah, which is just slightly north of Jerusalem. And he wants to attack and take possession of Jerusalem. So he sets up that, you know, no one can go in or out to Asa. Now, when we turn back to chapter 14 that we've already referred to, and we look in verse 11, When Asa is faced with this army from Ethiopia and Libya, and it's described as, you know, like a million men, which I don't take to be a literal number, but just an extremely, extremely large army. And he cries to help, "Oh Lord, there is none like you," okay, who can come to the help of someone like me, and I'm paraphrasing. What happened in chapter 16 when Baasha started fortifying and preparing to fight against Asa? Why did Asa not go to God again and make that same request of God? Why did he not exhibit that same humility there in year 36 that he had shown several years early in his reign? What happened? Who's got a comment on that? But why? John? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Well, it doesn't say for sure. But I think we can read on further in this account, and we'll start to get some ideas. Okay. Personally, I tend to agree with what John said, that he had gotten so confident that he began to think what was happening as far as the peace in the land and the prosperity became more of his own doing rather than the blessings from God. And that's something that we have to be aware of. It's something that successful people need to be aware of.
I've always heard a saying that prosperity is the Trojan horse that apostasy rides in on. So we've really got to watch, you know, guard ourselves.
And I think the study of several of these kings brings out that point that he just made. Prosperity can be good, but we've got to deal with it. It doesn't come without some strings attached. Now, those strings don't have to bind us. It's up to us how we're going to deal with them. See, concerning Rehoboam, Rehoboam had no choice in that 10 tribes were going to be taken from him. God told that in the days of Solomon before Rehoboam became king. He had no choice. His choice was how he was going to reign over the two tribes that God left him. Was he going to be faithful to God in reigning over those two tribes or not faithful to God? He chose not to be faithful to God. That was his choice. In like manner, when God gives us prosperity, it's up to us how we're going to handle it. Prosperity can get the best of a person. And that's what I see here. Pride is a part of that prosperity, getting the best of a person. A person begins to feel that he's done this. What were the words of Nebuchadnezzar as he looked out over his kingdom? What were his words? Look what I have done. And God did not take kindly to that at all, because we can read of the punishment that God put upon Nebuchadnezzar for that thought process. Look what I have done. In his early years, Asa knew it was not his doing. But now he seems to have changed his mind. And his thinking is perhaps that it is his doing. So instead of turning to God as he did before, he did like our sister said, he turned to the king of Syria. For the king of Syria to intervene. And the king of Syria did. And it worked. So perhaps now he's thinking after this, it worked. Of course, it cost him. He had to send in gold and silver. But it worked. And that can be so misguiding. Because we may judge the success of an act to mean that is acceptable to God. You know, we could do all sorts of things to get people in here, and we could claim success. But that doesn't mean it's acceptable to God. We can go out and amass, an empire. But that doesn't mean it's acceptable to God, you know, in the way that we went about doing it. So success to God is not measured by our accomplishments. And Asa should not have made that mistake either. But then, look what, you know, again, to pick up on verse 6, you know, Asa looks at that, and now he takes the building materials and he builds up two cities with it. So he certainly could be looking at this as a successful venture to bring in the king of Syria. But now a prophet comes to him. And what does this prophet bring up to him? Because you have done what? I'm sorry? Well, he had rebelled against God. And he did foolishly. That's right. He relied upon the king of Syria and did not rely on the Lord your God. And in that light, that was rebellion against God. And he had done so by bringing in the army of the king of Assyria. And not only that, the army of the king of Assyria had escaped from him. He could have destroyed them. But he didn't give himself the opportunity to do that. So then he brings him a reminder of what had happened with the Ethiopians and the Libyans. He says a huge army with many chariots and horsemen. But because he had relied upon the Lord had given them into his hands. Now notice what he says in verse 9. Somebody read verse 9. You know, the first couple of chapters emphasize the amount of peace that Asa had had in his reign. And now, the rest of his reign is not going to be a peaceful reign. What number of years is left in it? But I want us to look at this expression, the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth, to give support, strong support, to those whose heart is blameless toward him. God is just not backing you. He's not just being helpful to you. He will be an immense help to you if you want to do what's right. He's not just there cheering you on, like, you know, like at a football game. You know, the cheerleaders on the sideline can't do a whole lot about what goes on in the field. But God can do a whole lot about what happens to us in the days that we have ahead. And so he gives strong support to those whose heart is blameless toward him. See, God saw all the things that Asa did. God knew. You know, we've been reminded in the last class of Job at the beginning where the devil going to and fro. You see, well, to use that expression of Satan, he's not the only one going to and fro. God is. God sees you here and he sees somebody else that's on the other side of the world at the same time. He can see us all and see what we're doing. And so, in that light, we need to be aware of something. We need to be aware that God sees us. I need to be aware that God sees me. He saw Asa. He sees me. And he sees each one of you. Now, I kind of know what he sees when he sees me. Some of it's good. Some of it's not. You know what he sees when he sees you, if your heart is honest. We've got the parable in Matthew 25. You've got just people. Some gathered on the right hand, some gathered on the left. But each one, each individual one, regardless of which hand they were gathered on, God knew what they had done in their lives. Visit the sick? Yes or no? Help the needy? Yes or no? Help the hungry? Yes or no? God knew. Some made excuses. Didn't matter. God knew. Keep that in mind as you go about your daily life. God knows. Saying he knew what Asa did, that is a minor. That's small. He knows what all of us do. Any comment or question? Talk louder. If I follow what you're saying, Steve brought out many times in the class where Job would question the moral judgment of God. And if I'm following you in your comment, you're kind of making the same statement, that we have to be careful that we don't apply our limited understanding to God's judgment. Because with God, there is no limitation in understanding. And the things that God does for us are things that, if we take them properly, we can grow. And James 1 talks about that growth that comes through trials and sufferings and such. So that can mold us and shape us. And 1 Peter talks about this testing that comes through fire, where we come out of this testing, you know, pure, okay, as gold that's been refined and is pure. So if we take these things that come from God, just as that Job experienced, then they'll serve to make us better. You're saying to have none can also be dangerous. Well, it is. Yeah. That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. Any other comment? As we continue in the 16th chapter, and in verse 10, what was Asa's reaction to the words of this prophet? Angry. And it goes on to describe, does the verse continue in describing this anger? Part? Yeah, but even describing the anger itself, in a rage, you see. I mean, he was just furious. Furious. Does this seem so out of character from the man that had spent his first 35 years? You see, the way he had? See, he does something wrong. Is he the first king that's done something wrong in his later years? And he's not going to be the last. But it's what he did with it, you see. Now let's take King David. King David did wrong. The scriptures bring out the utter sinfulness of what David did. But what did David do when Nathan the prophet brought it to his attention? He repented. So here, Asa does wrong. It's not the same type of wrong. It's not, you know, the moral breakdown that David had, but it's a breakdown in his trust in God. And so the same scenario, late in his life, a prophet comes to Asa, tells him what he did wrong. Now we see a break from the way David had conducted himself. See, he's described as a man after God's own heart. Well, it's not those words used. He's described as a man who had done right as his father David had done. And we can look later on, you know, and we'll see, for instance, in chapter 21 and verse 12. And this is talking about his grandson, who was an evil king. Elijah comes to him and says, because you have not walked in the ways of Jehoshaphat, your father, or in the ways of Asa, king of Judah. Asa 1 or Asa 2, king of Judah, you see. He was talking about Asa in the years of Asa's faithfulness. So instead of repenting, he becomes angry and in a rage, and he puts the prophet in prison, puts him in stocks, and he inflicts cruelties among some of the people, probably the God-fearing people at the same time. And then in the 39th year, it says he was diseased in his feet, and his disease became severe. Yet even in this disease, what happened? Didn't seek the Lord. The Lord's breaking him down. He's just giving Asa the chance to take a look at his life. What have you done? What have you done to yourself? Will you come back? Now, if the Lord gives us time, we're going to look at Manasseh. Manasseh is described as the most wicked king they had. And it was during his reign, because it was so bad, that God decreed that the judgment of Babylon could not be reversed. He even tells Jeremiah later on, quit praying for the people. Don't even pray for them. But God punished Manasseh. He was taken captive. And in that captivity, he came to his senses, just like the prodigal son came to his senses. And he came back to the Lord, repented and came back. So God could take these kings and inflict upon them and give them a chance to return. Not Asa. He refused to seek the Lord. Instead, he did what? Anything wrong with that? Then why is it brought up? Did not Paul tell Timothy to take a little wine for his stomach's sake? Was not Luke a physician? What about? What's wrong with that? We've all been to the doctor. But let me ask you a question, and you don't have to raise your hand, because I hope there's no hands to be raised. But do you go to the doctor and not pray? Everybody that's had surgery, everybody in this room that's had surgery, I suspect that you pray. Your family pray. Others pray for you. I don't think the problem here is anyone's position, but that he didn't seek the Lord's help and go into the physician. Now, if the word physician here is another word for magicians and such as that,
I don't know that it is. I don't really believe that it is. But if it is, then you could understand not going to whatever it is. But I don't take it to mean that. I take it to face back. So, he didn't seek the Lord. So you put all this picture together. Not only did he do the dream in the Syrians, but then when it was brought to his attention that he did it wrong, he didn't repent. Did just the opposite, put the prophet in prison when he was became sick. He still refused to go to God, became obstinate in his ways. Whether that's the way he died or not, I don't know. But it's two different people in these different parts of his life. And the same thing can happen to us. I encourage you, let's not let whatever happens, whether it be prosperity or even as Jim brought out, it may be the loss of everything. But let's not let those things affect our relationship with God. The attitude of Job that he expressed was the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. And that's the attitude of these possessions. In 1 Corinthians, Paul says concerning meats and the question of meats that were offered to idols and could these meats be eaten in the circumstances and such as that. What do you say about meats? You'd rather not eat them. Meats didn't matter. Came to the salvation of the soul of his brother. Nothing matters in this life. Even the food that we eat, if it affects our salvation and the salvation of someone close to us.
Do you recall anywhere in the text that St. Mason at age when he began to reign? I don't remember finding it. But anyway, he reigned 35 years when this happened. Let's say he was 20 when he started. That makes him mid-50s when this happened. He seemed to have lost his faith. And 39 with the disease in his feet. And you would think a man that's 55 years old who's trusted in the Lord all those years, you know, well, young people are in danger of losing their faith. Here's a man in his 50s, maybe 60s, who's lost his faith. Same thing happened with David. He was probably in his mid-50s when he had his affair with Bathsheba. And so it's a lesson to all of us. As we get older, we may think, oh, we'll rest on our laurels and walk and learn this path in our faith. But even though we're older and we've studied the Bible for years, those of us who are older need to nurture that faith, because whether we're 50 or 60 or 70, we can lose that faith and our reliance on the Lord.
Lesson from Mason. Remember tonight, there's a handout side here now. There's two handouts. One on the false gods was the worst of their day. The other on the six kings of Israel. But I'll have some more handouts, Lord willing, hopefully tonight, if I can find a place to print. Thanks.